I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source. A brave experiment is underway in the art of telling the truth of things, the truth of a life. Readers around the world are in on it now with the Norwegian writer Karl Ove Knausgård. He restarted his career in Norway 7 years ago with a plunge into memory. It became 3,600 pages in 6 volumes of what he called My Struggle. The fourth came out in English translation this week. Here's how young writers react to the name Knausgård over at the Writer's Room and the Grub Street Workshop in Boston this week.
There's really no plot. There are no characters to speak of. There's no framework, no structure, no real level of sophistication necessarily, but I couldn't put it down.
It is oddly hypnotic.
When I first picked it up, I'd heard it described a little bit like what Proust did. When I began reading it, I realized it wasn't at all in style what Proust did. The language is much more rough and raw. It sort of reads like it was written quickly in the moment. I was amazed at how riveted I was by it, though, even though what he's describing is so mundane.
There are scenes where he's just making tea, and you're riveted, you're turning the pages.
I hear the French don't like it. There's no sex.
I have to say, his face is engaging.
It's almost easier to say why it shouldn't work than why it does work. I mean, it's a 6-volume book that's called My Struggle.
It feels to me like I'm reading fiction, but it's actually a memoir.
I felt like a narcissist because I couldn't get myself out of it. I was enjoying being inside of his head.
That makes him a narcissist, not you.
Reading Knausgård, you begin to hear his favorite song from American rock, which we're hearing, The Great Curve, from the Talking Heads. He's writing the trials of boyhood, trying to get attentions with a chilly dad, an encouraging mom. There's a bad marriage, then a good one, and the intrusion of kids that relight his life and crowd his writing time. Most of it delivered with the calm of a security camera, waiting for bursts of emotion and insight, and they don't disappoint. James Wood is our guest to get us started. He's the New Yorker book critic and Harvard wise man who got the Knausgård bug early. He admires a kind of tirelessness in Knausgård. But then William Dorisiewicz, the contrarian refugee from the Ivy League, is going to kick the tires of My Struggle. He wonders if somebody's pulling our leg. The poet and memoirist Megan O'Rourke is a notable feminist voice in Knausgård's favor. And Boston writers hard at work are going to tell how the Knausgård example has reset their compasses. Our guest James Wood introduced the first volume of Knausgård to New Yorker readers almost 3 years ago on the judgment that the story, which had been read and embraced by 1 in every 10 Norwegians, would work for Americans too. Remind us why, James.
The first thing that I was struck by when I read the book, this is volume one of a project that in English we only have 4 volumes of, was that there was an uncommon seriousness about the writing. There's a great deal of American fiction and nonfiction too, certain kinds of, you know, sensationalist or redemptive memoir that is not serious.
And meaning ironic or distanced? Or?
Meaning engaged either in puerile humor, knowing irony, escapism of various kinds, fairy tale, hyperactive storytelling. In some ways, all of those things that I'm describing, when I say not serious, I mean a seriousness that's compatible with innocence somehow, with simplicity. When Knausgård, for instance, I think at some point in volume one, looks at people walking past him in I think it's Stockholm, actually, and says, you know, they're all alive now, but in 30 years' time, they'll all, you know, 40, 50, 60 years' time, they'll all be dead. Or when he writes about himself, you know, I'll soon be 40, and when I'm 40, I'll soon be 50. When I'm 50, I'll soon be 60. And when I'm 60, I'll soon be 70. I have to continue because this is how he continues it in that rather tedious way. And then that's it. It'll be over. There's nothing especially, certainly not nothing, there's nothing eloquent about the phrasing. But the simplicity and pungency and innocence of the truth-telling struck me immediately. And what I mean by that seriousness and innocence is an awareness precisely of rhythms of life and death. That we have the sort of rhythms that the psalmist knows. You know, the Psalm 121, the Lord will know you're going out and you're coming in.
You're sitting down and getting up.
Right. Indeed, all that too. But in the largest sense, the form of our life is our going out and our coming in. Mm. And it seemed to me that is absolutely a rhythm, say, that Tolstoy knew. It's a rhythm that Proust knew. I don't think those two writers are much like Knausgård, although perhaps Tolstoy is closer. But it's a rhythm, a metaphysical rhythm that Knausgård knows and is only interested in exploring, I would say.
I like those words, the pungency, innocence, honesty of the truth-telling. I want to say I'm into volume 3 and I'm still of two minds. My big question is, how far can you go studying your own entrails, so to speak, your own history? And is that the way to find the answer?
Well, I'd say in defense, yes, of course, it's his own entrails. But these entrails are inside a body. The body belongs to a gender. The gender, it belongs to a society. The society belongs to a period. And indeed, I would say that volume that you're talking about, volume 3, the childhood one, is a very intense sociology as much as anything else of childhood. Indeed, when I read it, because a lot of his references, being Norwegian, are English, say to English football teams like Liverpool football team, certain kinds of sports gear, a lot of the music. I have the eerie sense that he's describing my childhood with amazing accuracy. So I'd say you can go quite a long way with your own entrails.
You've sat with him on stage and interviewed him and obviously engaged the man himself. What does that tell you?
I'd say in person he's full of contradictions, and I think those contradictions are what make the books appealing and rich. He's clearly very contradictory about masculinity. He needs, in some ways, to prove himself as an old-fashioned male who's threatened by, you know, pushing strollers around.
Exactly.
On the other hand, writes about children, I think, and having children, parenting, better than any male writer, contemporary male writer than I could think of. He's ashamed about a great deal, but seemingly not ashamed, or he wouldn't be writing the books he's writing. He's contradictory about language. Churns out enormous amounts of it, doesn't seem to care what the quality of the writing is in some ways, and on the other hand is also trying constantly to break down language and get beyond language to a truth beyond it. Anyway, all those contradictions that you find on the page are brought together in him too. He's surprisingly, you're not going to believe this, but he's surprisingly shy. And he's told me a couple of times now, because I've interviewed him twice, that before going on stage he's intensely nervous and is sort of smoking outside and feels sick. And you think, how can this be true? I mean, if this was the case, why would you come back for more punishment? But it doesn't make sense. And maybe the not making sense, you know, the contradictory politics and gender and so on is gender attitudes are a part of the complexity of the book.
Comparisons are odious, my mother used to say, but we got to make some. Starting with Proust, Dostoevsky, Chekhov. People want to compare him to Dostoevsky and those lonely men of the Petersburg White Knights. It's his terrain almost, the soulful underground. But Knausgård is not in the world of passionate intellectuals or political rebels or Christian saints either, as Dostoevsky is.
No. Well, he has one connection with Dostoevsky, and he does indeed talk about Dostoevsky at one point in Volume 2. I think his connection with Dostoevsky is he's still hung up on the exploration of large ideas. Theodicy, disenchantment.
Theodicy meaning good and evil in God's world. Good
and evil in God's world. I mean, the rant he has about Dostoevsky in Volume 2 goes something like this. It used to be the case that serious people argued passionately about Dostoevsky because he wrote about the ultimate issues. Then it became the case that really Dostoevsky was taken over by students, every adolescent had to go through a Dostoevsky phase. And for him, that's a sign of decline. He feels that if Dostoevsky is simply put out to pasture with students, then, or put out into the academy, then that's no way to be. I'd say I don't think there's much connection there with Proust, despite the fact of his flagging it by mentioning Proust and all the
3,000 words on a man discovering
right,
he's a writer after
stuff.
All.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's a different kind of inquiry. I mentioned Tolstoy, and I think maybe Tolstoy is the closest writer. There's the simplicity of language. There's the radical innocence and transparency. Mm. There's the childlike. The thing that Shlovsky noticed about Tolstoy, which is, you know, he makes things strange and unfamiliar often by describing them from the point of view of a child. So there's the childlike quality
That's a quick touching of bases. We didn't mention Chekhov. He's as gray as Chekhov, the man who Nabokov said was everywhere between the color of an old fence and a low-flying cloud. But none of the precision, the absolute concision of... But we'll come back to all that. Coming up, Henry James said the trick required of the novelist is boiling down the complexities of human truth to intensity, lucidity, brevity, beauty. Our guest, William Dereisiewicz, finds them mostly missing in My Struggle. This is Open Source.
Jag ser aldrig det jag egentligen tänker. Aldrig det jag egentligen menar. Men lägger mig alltid tätt upp till den jag till var tid pratar med. Later som om det säger intresserar mig. Bortsett från när jag dricker. Där jag som oftast går för långt den andra vägen. För att vakna till
överskridens angst som bara vuxit med åren. On the Epic of Memory and Introspection by the Norwegian Karl Ove Knausgård, Volume 4 of this My Struggle, just out in English, flying off shelves all over the place, our guest, William Dereisiewicz, is a doubter, and he bites, as in his own memoir last year of teaching in the Ivy League. His book was Excellent Sheep. My Struggle, you say, Mr. Dereisiewicz, is a box of snapshots. No, a steamer trunk, a shipping container of little memories, a giant selfie. Where do you place it as literature?
Well, I'm certainly not going to say that it isn't literature. And I want to start by stipulating that this is going to be largely a matter of disagreement. He's the kind of thing you like if you like that kind of thing. And certainly a lot of readers, and in particular a lot of writers, clearly do, including a lot of writers and critics for whom I have a great deal of respect. But it's funny, when I read James Wood, or I think you're going to have Bill Pierce soon, who just wrote a long three-part thing about Knausgård in the LA Review of Books, when I read them on Knausgård, I think, this sounds like a great novel. It sounds really interesting. And then I remember my own experience of having read the 1,400-odd pages of the first three parts, and it was mainly an experience of boredom. It reminds me of the joke about Wagner, right? That his music is better than it sounds. You know? I agree with a lot of what James Wood said about the virtues of the book, but to me they come embedded in an enormous sea of very flat writing, description that doesn't really do anything. If he wants to represent the boredom and banality of everyday life by writing boring, banal prose, well, first of all, that's the imitative fallacy. That isn't how you have to do it, or I think how you should do it. But even if he wants to do that, does he need to do that for 3,600 pages? Can he not make these points more briefly.
But what if the difference here is that people who love him are bringing a great deal of themselves to the process? They're doing a lot of work in reading it, and I find that myself. He draws on us.
I think that's true, and I think that's part of the problem I have with it. And this may not be fair to say, but it is significant to me that he does seem to be a writer who is particularly beloved of other writers. Zadie Smith said that if you were a married writer with children, you will especially like his work because you will find yourself in it. But to me, finding yourself in fiction is not about reading about someone who's exactly like you in your demographic coordinates. It's about being able to see yourself in whomever because the writer has enabled you to do that. I would actually say, and this goes to James Wood's comparison of him to Tolstoy, to me, one of the biggest problems with him, and especially one of the biggest problems with him as the writer that everyone is now lionizing, is precisely that, unlike, very, very, very much unlike Tolstoy, he has not only no ability to understand other people, but he has said in the novel and outside of the novel that he has no interest in understanding other people. Joyce and Proust, pioneers of autobiographical fiction, were also intensely interested in representing people different from themselves. And in Knausgård, as he says in the novel, everywhere I looked, I saw only myself.
But I thought he's putting himself down. He's trying to listen. William de Riesert, I want to introduce Megan O'Rourke, who joins us by phone. She's a poet, and her memoir of her mother was titled The Long Goodbye, a book that moved me, Megan, I got to say, and not least with the effects of compression.
Mm.
what do you make of our man from Norway?
I agree with both my other interlocutors here. I think that this is a really significant project. I think it's significant for really complicated reasons, some of which do have to do with that state of boredom that William was describing, which was familiar to me from reading it, especially as you all may remember this sort of a 60-page scene of him trying to buy some beer and hide it along the side of the road when he's going to a New Year's party and in Volume 1. And it's sort of a masterpiece of what you're not supposed to do as a writer, but I think the project is really complicated. It's one that kind of pushes you out of it and pulls you into it, or did for me in a lot of different ways. And one of the things that I would say about the book is, or about the project, is that I think it is trying to get at things about modern day life through this flatness, right? And trying to get at things about the sort of our sense of belatedness as, you know, beings with longings and spiritual cravings. But it's also a book about time. And for me, a lot of the book is really about not only being a parent, but being a son. And the core of this project, I think, lies in the relationship between the narrator, who is a Karl Ove Knausgård, right, and his father, who is a kind of quasi-abusive, very unpredictable figure. And that part of the project to me seems to be about recreating a world in which you never know if something really traumatic is going to happen, which was the case for the young Karl Ove, that his father would suddenly kind of lose his temper, be very angry, even physically violent. And that it's really interesting listening to the clip you guys played earlier of people talking about reading the book, and so many people reading it use the word riveting, and a word that critics kept using was hypnotizing. And so for me, one of the interesting questions is, well, why is a book that is so often quite boring and contains scenes in which,
I got to ask you very simply, I mean, could a woman write this long about so little, in a sense, and be called riveting?
Well, you know, that's the kind of question I don't like to answer in the abstract, because I don't think we truly know the answer. I do think that, you know, I know Katie Royce made the argument that no woman could have written this book and gotten the accolades she got. I think, you know, it would be harder for a woman to write a book like this and get the accolades that Knausgård has gotten. I think, for one thing, critics would focus more on the negatives. There's a lot of negatives here, like these kind of patches of quite bad writing. But again, I think one reason for that is that he's writing about being a parent and being a man who kind of wants to be a sort of sensitive liberal father and who feels very emasculated by that. And he's writing about what that being this kind of, you know, contemporary, you know, two-parent family, what that is like for a man. And I think this is part of why so many critics, especially male critics, have liked it, is that it really is describing a kind of experience we haven't seen described very much yet in literature.
James Wood, jump back in, especially on this question of it's so boring, it's exciting.
Yeah. I agree with a fair amount that William was saying about, as I think Megan does too, the negatives are easy to state. Knausgård will admit to them and indeed exaggerate them. He'll say that he said to me that the only decent writing in the whole thing is the first 10 pages. And all the rest, I mean, he said to an audience, all the rest doesn't come up to my usual standard. And everyone started laughing. And he said, no, I mean that seriously. Hmm. I was just trying to do it as fast as possible as part of some experiment. And I'm struck by that experimental tendency in him, the desire to break the forms down. But where I disagree with William is, and maybe Megan is on my side here a bit, I don't think it's just about, I mean, you can't in the same way that you can't simply say it's just boring, you can't simply say either that it's some attempt to talk, you know, to imitate boredom, to represent the boredom of modern life. It seems to me actually that the real key is as a line in volume 3 where he says meaning, meaninglessness, meaning, meaninglessness, meaninglessness. This is the wave that crashes through one's life. I think he's beset by the extraordinary variability of existence that actually, you know, suddenly you fall in love and for 3 months time goes very fast and you can't think about anything else. Or actually, does time go rather slowly? That's one of the interesting things. Whatever happens, something happens and life is full of meaning. And then suddenly it isn't full of meaning any longer. And I think that's why he writes so beautifully about childhood, because he absolutely understands that when you're a child, you have a particular relation to certain objects, or not even objects, things like a bowl of cornflakes, and that somehow that disappears as you get older, and that's something to lament. That's elegiac.
I want to ask you all three about autobiography, fiction, what makes it literature, if anything. This book drives me into my own story, but if I were telling it, I'd want to find letters. I'd want to find what siblings were observing. I'd want to find not photographs necessarily, but report cards, you know, suspensions or whatever, driver's licenses, evidence. It's all out of one man's memory, undocumented. I find that strange. What do you make of that, Megan?
Well, I mean, Proust's great novel was all out of his memory, so I don't find that to be I don't find that to be a problem in of itself. I think that's a prerogative of a writer to explore, you know, his or her memory. So I think that this book is very self-consciously making use of questions of genre, which could be meaningless. One could self-consciously do that and have it not be an engaging project. But I do think it's really engaging here. And I think that for me, again, it has a lot to do with this kind of sense of some of those rhythms that James was talking about meaning and meaninglessness. I mean, he has a passage where he uses the phrase, my struggle, which, of course, in the Norwegian sounds a bit like Mein Kampf, and it's Min Kampf, I think. And he talks about his struggle as being the struggle of kind of trying to find meaning in this world of domesticity. But I think what makes the book sing in places is this very intense relationship to time and to his own memory and this kind of compulsion to revisit his father and his father's death. I mean, he said, too, that this book began as an attempt to write about his father, but he wrote it as fiction, you know, kind of much more explicitly as fiction, and kept realizing, no, I wasn't interested in a made-up character. I was interested in my father. But, of course, as anyone who's written a memoir knows, even writing a memoir, you're writing a fiction, right? And there's a way in which the act of writing changes things and foregrounds things and creates these patterns and resonances that I think are very much in this book, and it's kind of attention to time and objects and what makes life feel heightened to us and what makes it feel flat to us.
Megan, listen to this. Knausgård himself has said the book was undertaken to address a crisis in fiction.
Over recent years, I had increasingly lost faith in literature. I read and thought this is something someone has made up. Perhaps it was because we were totally inundated with fiction and stories. It had got out of hand. Wherever you turned, you saw fiction. All these millions of paperbacks, hardbacks, DVDs, and TV series, they were all about made-up people in a made-up, though realistic, world. And it made no difference whether what they told had actually happened or not. It was a crisis.
Thanks to the New York Public Library for that tape. Back to you, Megan, or maybe Bill DeResovich, this is for you. What is this uneasiness with fiction that he's addressing?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure because I don't share it, but it does seem to be a widespread feeling in literary circles these days that somehow fiction is a fake, that somehow fiction is impermissible. What I think is important to say here, especially after that clip, is that he claims to renounce fiction and he claims to draw on memory, but it's clear that he's not really, Bill Pierce says this in his piece, he's not really remembering everything that happened 40 years ago in the incredible minute detail in which he represents it. He presents memory in a totally unproblematic way, actually. I think unlike many other writers who draw on memory, he remembers things as if he were watching a surveillance tape. And of course, he's also shaping. I mean, it's a big mistake to think that this is simply formless. There's a lot of chronological complexity, at least in the first couple of volumes. So, I mean, which is it, right? I mean, is he going to renounce fiction making and shaping, or is he not? And I'm perhaps other. Some people think that that's a great conundrum. I think it's problematic.
Megan O'Rourke, do you believe his memory?
Well, I actually think he does make memory problematic. In book three, at the beginning, he says memory is not a he does this thing where he kind of undoes that. Because I totally agree, there are so many places where he seems to present it as this completely unproblematic thing, and it raises a lot of questions in the reader's mind. But then at the beginning of book three, he says memory is not a reliable quantity in life. And then he describes his own childhood, which he has just given to us. He goes on in the book to give to us in kind of incredibly precise detail. I think at the beginning he describes it as in his memory being a ghetto-like state of incompleteness that he's built from kind of bits and pieces of photographs and memories of objects. So I think that there's actually an incredible tension that's very explicit in the work, especially in the third book, about the project itself and its reliability.
Describe that tension. What do you mean?
Well, I'm saying he's as William is saying absolutely accurately, he seems to, you know, kind of give you these scenes, you know, in kind of, you know, I was going to say exquisite, but maybe not always exquisite detail, right? It's kind of very, very detailed as if they're fresh to his memory and he's kind of looking upon the inward scenes of life and everything is coming back crisply. But then, so that's a stylistic presentation of the novel. But then as he's in, you know, launching into that period of deep childhood, again in book three, which kind of reprises a lot of book one, he explicitly builds in this kind of several-page meditation about how unreliable his own memory is and how it's something he's in some sense fictionalizing from photographs and memories and objects that are, you know, around him.
Right, but I wouldn't call that a tension because it's not taken into the form of the novel. I would call that a contradiction that I don't think he's resolved. He says it at the beginning, and then he acts as if he ignores it. And I would say, to go back to something James said earlier, he also says at the beginning of that volume that he's placing his story in the context of the history that it occurred in, the history of Norway during those years. But I don't see any penetration of history. It's not surprising to me that James can really identify with it because to me it's a very generic kind of Western boyhood. So he, you know, he sort of makes these framing statements that he often doesn't really live up to in the actual execution of the story.
James Wood, it's precisely the exquisiteness that I miss in this book. I mean, compared to Proust, most obviously, we don't get the Hawthorns. We don't get the meditations on a child's jealousy of the first girl that ever just knocked him down, much less the color, the smell of asparagus. There's a lack of refinement, reconsideration.
Well, hang on. There I disagree with you. I think actually one of the interesting things here, you know, we were just talking about breaking fictional forms down. I think one of the really interesting things is he's part of a larger group of people who are talking in different ways about their restlessness with conventional fictional machinery, and this has been a motif certainly of the last 60 years in contemporary writing. But if you compare him, say, with certain writers who I happen to like Ben Lerner, say, what you don't get in Knausgård is what you might expect to get, which is having, you know, deconstructed the forms, then you get a sort of spectatorial fatigue actually what you get is an old-fashioned, you get the opposite of postmodernism. He sounds, to me, much more like Wordsworth or Hölderlin or Schiller than he does a contemporary postmodernist. He's actually going back and talking precisely about what is it like to stand right next to a tree. There's a marvelous description of page and a half about trees in Volume 3. What is it like to put your finger, your hand next to the bark of the tree and live under the tree?
We'll come back to it. And all the messages in Knausgård that are not about writing, they're about Scandinavian social democracy, about Facebook psychology, about narcissism. And isn't there a thread of exhaustion in all this? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What we learn from fiction, from the novelist Karl Ove Knausgård and his six-volume struggle about writing, about life. Here are two writers we know and two different lessons they're learning. First, Louis Cronin, our sometime colleague, and then William Pierce, senior editor of the literary magazine Agni.
When I first started writing, I was more like him. I was free as a bird. I would, like, just pour it out, and it was like all I wanted to talk about was my father, and I was so free. I couldn't stop writing. I wrote on the subway, between stops. I wrote everywhere. And then when I started learning how to write, and everybody told me, no, you can't use adverbs. No, you can't. That's a cliche, and there's no structure. Nothing happened. It's like I've gotten tighter and tighter and tighter. And this guy's loose, or feels loose.
The fiction that I'm writing now is quite different from what I was doing before, precisely because it's less concerned with external ideas, received ideas of what literary means. His work is literary because of what it does, but not because quite of how it's written. He gets us all asking, or certainly has gotten me asking, where does my truth really lie? It doesn't lie in wrought sentences. He knows that we can easily lose interest. And the strange phenomenon in Knausgård is that we don't.
Can you imagine a Knausgård period coming out of this sensation?
I can. I hope that it won't be a period of everybody writing multi-volume autobiographical novels, because I think that would be a very narrow take on what Knausgård has given us.
What would it be?
I believe it would be a time when cleverness and literary language are always put in the service of heart truths, of our deepest sense of what it is for us to be human and alive at this moment.
Thank you, Bill Pierce. Thank you, Louis Cronin. But so much about writers. Enough. What does this rampant Knausgårdismo say about our era, James Wood, our striving, our sorrows, about us?
Well, I think one way to read him, and I don't think this is, I'm not putting anything in that isn't there. I mean, he writes about this himself, is as a in some ways, a fairly typical product of late 20th century, early 21st century secular disenchantment. The gestures of religious reverence are there, much of the language, but the God that you might appeal to has disappeared. And I think that's why he talks so much about, either explicitly or implicitly, about feeling at home as a child and not feeling at home as an adult. And, of course, that homelessness, I think, can be is partly theological or spiritual, shall we say. It's partly, it would seem, political. That's when he starts sort of going on his rants about, you know, living in the modern Swedish welfare state, and you know how, you know, he has this thing about how justice has taken over. Specifically, I think his claim is that serious discussion about transcendent issues or about transcendence has been replaced by easier forms of that discussion, namely discussion about justice, but even within that, not even very important areas of talking about justice, just simply verbal stuff like what you can say, policing, what you can
absolutely
say, what you can't
that,
say.
That disenchantment is what I meant by exhaustion or an air of depression. Here's the paradox. He embodies world literature this week anyway.
Uh-huh.
But imagine reading him in India or Latin America or Africa. A reader there would see in Knausgaard's world some very typical suburban Euro-American mm-hmm. TV, rock music, McDonald's, good highways, car culture, high school sports, sex, drugs, drinking, all in a kind of social, democratic, and welfare state of Scandinavia that has, I don't know, mysteriously little pride about itself, not much controversy. It's an advanced society, but not a happy one. Not much yeah. laughter. And I think Dostoevsky would be saying, I warn you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't know how a reader in India or wherever might respond. But you can imagine a reader who began to feel all the things you were talking about and then suddenly turns a page and gets a shock because the same writer who seems exactly those things you were talking about is pushing very hard against it, says, in effect, I hate the age in which I live in. I'd rather go back to the 16th century. I don't want to live in this age any longer. This modern, you know, this product of the modern welfare state can sound actually like a fascist nihilist at times. It's not surprising. I mean, it's no accident, I think, that he talks about Ernst Junger and so on. There's a maybe he's just taking a rant for a stroll at times. You feel in a Thomas Bernhardt like way in the book, seeing what he can get away with. But you do feel that around that there's an energy in these books that is angry and disenchanted and sort of worth quarreling with.
Yeah, Megan O'Rourke, I wonder what's the news in this book.
Well, I mean, I really
for our age, about
I
our age.
I really agree with James. I mean, I think a writer we haven't compared him to, a writer that he might seem very unlike, and he is very unlike in some ways, is Michel Houellebecq, who, you know,
don't know her. Sorry,
a man, actually, a French writer. The reason I bring up Houellebecq is that I feel in Knausgaard there's a profound question about masculinity in the contemporary age, and especially in this, as Jane was saying, the social welfare state. You know, and there's at times absolutely this kind of fascist nihilist energy that a lot of the intellectual and literary references are you know, sort of, you know, he talks about his friend Gere and kind of reading all this anti-liberal literature and philosophy, and there is a real tension in this book. I'm really curious to read the last volume, which I think contains quite a lot about Hitler in it. And to me, so much of this project is about this question of where do we find value today and how does literature potentially help us or not help us do that. To me, the news is in that, and it has something to do with masculinity and its sense of being.
Bill DeResearch, what are you learning about us? For example, the narcissism of the Facebook era, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I know narcissism is a really overworked word now. It's hard for me to think of an example in which it's more apt. You know, we were talking about whether a woman could write something like this. I thought of Elena Ferrante, and I'm kind of hoping that the Ferrante craze, which I'm much more on board with, displaces the Knausgaard craze, not just because I think she, despite writing, you know, a four-part long novel, has the virtues of compression and drama and caring about the experiences of other people, but because she's taken the radical step of completely effacing herself to the point where we don't know who she is. We theoretically don't even know that she's a woman, although probably she is. But so much of the response to Knausgård, as I've been reading it, the positive response, has to do with his self-revelation, the fact that this is him. And to me, that's not a literary fact. That's a biographical fact. I don't care about him. I care about what he can put on the page. So, yes.
Let me say, having mentioned Facebook, I mean, he's drilling deep, deep inside that narcissism of Facebook. It's not about cats or, you know, I was going to say it's not about babies, but it is. But it's going much, much further.
Well, listen, some of it definitely does. And again, I agree with a lot of the positive things that have been said, if I can stipulate that they are only to be found for me in, you know, a relatively small fraction of the book. But you could see a lot of this book being written one Facebook post at a time.
One blog entry at a time.
So it's not necessarily that different.
You don't agree, James Wood?
I suppose you could. They'd be really good blogs, though.
Bill?
Okay. Well, listen, I mean, you know, the minutia of everyday actions and events. And yes, he will then write a passage, write beautiful essayistic passages about mortality, about a sense of meaninglessness. I don't see why we need quite so much of what comes in between, or really very much at all of what comes in between. And to me, that's significant, you know? I'm willing, you know, they're great four-hour movies. I don't know that we need a 24-hour movie that could have done the same thing in 4 hours.
Actually, it's interesting you bring up movies because I think it's somewhere said that before beginning the project, he'd been watching Shoah, and he'd got a sense of of formlessness, or whatever the word is. I agree with William that it's not without form, so we shouldn't perhaps say formlessness. But he presumably from that project, he got a sense of the space he needed, and the relaxation of form that was needed in order to be patient. And I would say, you know, see, the Tolstoy who has Prince Andrei ride past the tree twice in War and Peace and stops to describe it, or the Tolstoy who writes wonderfully about boyhood and childhood and starts that book with the little boy in bed and the fly, you know, flying above the bed and hearing the servants outside and just takes the time to do it, would absolutely have understood what Knausgård is about. Although I don't disagree that there's a lot of he probably even Tolstoy might have felt that there was an element of loose, baggy monsterism to it.
Your turn, Megan O'Rourke.
I don't. To me, this doesn't seem like a book that could be written on Facebook. Although I take the point about the kind of banality of parts of it. I guess, you know, the way I would defend this book is to say I think part of what it's trying to do. I don't think it's the most important thing it's trying to do, but I do think part of what it's trying to do is to include more kind of our inner mental experience of the days than other novels have been able to because they're shorter. And I think this is its justification for its length, is that in this crisis he was having with fiction, his response to it, the way he sort of tried to, you know, almost make fiction seem less contrived to himself and more meaningful, was actually to include more of just the everyday ways we think and the kind of collisions of the larger scale, more, you know, kind of meaningful, significant thoughts we might have, and then the really everyday ones of, you know, we're making tea and we're observing how the teapot works, or we're, you know, looking at our new sneakers and really enjoying them while thinking about, you know, art. And this is, it could seem like a really contrived or trite project, but actually I take it to be a really significant, important one, and it did do something to me as a reader. And I guess that's you know, there are moments where I think, oh, is this, you know, is he pulling my leg? But then I think it really does do something to me, a reader. It really does do something to me in my experience of the world and my experience of subjectivity. And
can I mention just a weird little digital detail? I found myself unbidden going to Google Earth to find Kristiansand in southern Norway and the highways and zoom in on this, that, the trees, the, you know, the satellite pictures, everything. And then in volume two, there he is consulting Google Earth.
But my real point is, does he live up to, you know, the challenge of thinking globally, thinking of one human race in desperate trouble?
I don't know. I don't know how you would do that as a writer, except to write about your own place and your own time anyway.
That's true.
But I think he does, indeed. And you just gave testament to it, that you have a desire to find find that place that he's written about, see it. I think that's fabulous.
But I was also discovering, you know, what I know nothing about Norway, but it's 5.1 million people. That's fewer people than in the state of Massachusetts. Mm. Much ado about a lot of white folks up there in the trees. That's part of my feeling reading him.
Well, yes. Look at volume four. The young 18-year-old gets to this idyllic fishing village. It all seems great. The sea is blue, and he thinks it's going to be terrific. And then it takes him precisely 15 minutes to walk to the edge of the village, and then he suddenly comes back to his place, and he realizes these are the 15 minutes that circumscribe my life for the next year. And you realize actually it's like some horror out of Hamsun that the young atheist is going to be trapped in this mediocre, tiny little place.
I got to ask, what does it tell us that, you know, he came to America for the New York Times Magazine to report on Norwegians and Scandinavians in this country, Detroit, this, that, and the other. And everybody seems to say, including himself, that he wasn't up to listening to a big story like that. Maybe Bill, to research.
Well, can I very quickly just say, to me, I have no problem with the fact that he's white, from Norway, middle class, male. I mean, to me, criticism should not be a demographic census. It's not better if your skin color is darker. So that's not the issue. As for, what they called my saga in the New York Times, which I think, you know, if you want to get a sense of what I had a problem with Knausgård, you can just read that. It's not just that he couldn't get his arms around America. Who is going to be able to in 10 days? He says he wasn't interested in listening. He wasn't interested in talking to other people. It took the photographer to suggest to him that he get in contact with his cousin in North Dakota.
Whose cousin?
His own cousin, right? He has a cousin in Knausgård in North Dakota, but it wasn't until the photographer suggested that he get in touch with him that it occurred to him to do so. Listen, he has plenty of virtues as a writer, okay? I would have much fewer problems with him if he weren't the writer of the moment.
Three virtues that you grant to him.
Me?
Yeah.
Look, his essayistic passages, his contemplative reflective passages are often sublime. His ability to write about nature can also be the passage about the tree, absolutely. I guess the audacity of the project and the freedom that it might grant to other writers, like one of the ones you played on tape.
Megan, three virtues you want to be remembered for granting him?
Definitely the essayistic. I mean, as William said, the essayistic. I mean, it's interesting. I do think that the opening pages of Volume 1 are really sublime, and it's interesting that he has said that he thinks that is of a quality that the rest of the book doesn't have, because I think those pages do feel different from much of the rest of the book. So the essayistic passages, some of them at least, I would say the writing about domesticity, the writing about marriage, I think in Volume 2 is really, really powerful. And number 3, I would say this thing that he's able to do of imbuing really seemingly insignificant moments of life with an extraordinary sense of tension and ambiguity and even suspense. That, I think, is a really powerful aspect of the books and the project.
Thank you. James Wood, we've got your three. Pungency, innocence, honesty. Thank you all. James Wood, William Dorisowicz, and Megan O'Rourke. Look for our James Wood podcast at radioopensource.org any day now. Thanks to Louis Cronin and Bill Pierce, and to the Writers' Room and Grub Street in Boston. We're going out on Heroes by David Bowie, another Knausgård favorite. You can find a full playlist of the sound of my struggle on our website, radioopensource.org. You can also find Max Larkin's interview with a Canadian writer, Sheila Hetty, the author of her own novel, From Life. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomino, with help from Rebecca Panovka. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our literary editor. I'm Christopher Lydon, and I struggle every day for open source.